The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Yo, 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 and welcome back to Creeps and Crumbs
Podcast.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Morgan, and happy episode season four. Episode season four. That makes
episode
sense.
Season four.
Episode 158. Question?
Yeah, question is answered. That is right.
I can't believe we're in season four.
I feel crazy because, guys, we're still trying to figure out how to sit in these chairs. So we're like, we look like we're photoshopped onto them.
No, and I feel like I have eyes all on.
I do too.
Because we have cameras at every angle.
At every angle. And hi. Wave at your camera.
Hi.
Yeah, guys, we're really going to be smashing the year turb, but we're still going to be releasing them 24 hours after they release on the RSS feed.
Yeah.
At least. It could be 48 depending on what's going on.
But you need to jump on and see this guy.
Yeah.
This is the new Stude.
This is the new Stude. And we're obsessed with
her. She's so cute.
And guys, don't forget to be on merch lookout because we have another one dropping for you. If you haven't seen it already, we already have our season four merch out.
444,
bitch. So.
And did anyone catch the little hint in the video?
If you did, love you even more.
It was the wallpaper.
Yep.
On Taylor's phone at the end. It was at the end.
At the end.
And to give you a little more like insight on it, it's a parody. It's found footage. We glitched into a back room and we are a parody of a horror film.
Yeah. It's like if what would happen if your podcast hosts were actually in the cases that they were talking about. That's exactly what it is. And I feel like the way that we would be exactly how we did in there.
I know.
Which is exactly why it is that way.
And it's almost like, you know, like when you glitch and stuff and it's almost like a fever dream. That's where we get the, oh my gosh, fashion shoot, the cat, the pickles. It was a lot of fun to film. We stayed up so late doing
it. So freaking late.
But it was a lot of fun. David and Nate did awesome.
Yep.
So shout out to them. They are the same 12 ones.
12 Bishop.
12 Bishop. Yep. They are the same ones that recorded and edited our season three little music video, hype video that we did.
They did such an amazing job. We knew from working with them last year that we definitely wanted to do something a little bit more.
Us.
A little bit more dramatic than what we did last year.
We wanted to be actors. So.
We wanted to be actresses. So that's what we did. But we knew that they would be like the perfect people for it. They were so amazing. We just like told them this concept. And there was like 15 that we went through. And
should we tell them the OG concept?
Oh my God, no. We'll save that for Patreon. And then we'll tell you guys eventually because it is hilarious. We just have to see how you guys react to the other one.
Oh, that one would be so funny.
Yeah, we'll do like a tell-all behind. We'll do like the regular behind the scenes that Patreon's going to get. But we're also going to tell you the truth about everything that went down because it was ridiculous, the first concept that we had. But we handed over, we changed the concept a million times. We finally like came down to the one that we wanted, like having a conversation. We hopped on a call with David and we were like, okay,
this is what we want.
This is, we finally figured it out. And as we're sitting on the phone call, he's like walking through these like ideas and the way that he's going to shoot it and the way that it's going to look on camera. And just like the overall concept of it.
And he was all for it.
He was so excited.
Like, I love back rooms.
Exactly.
We're like, perfect.
We were like, this is it. And they also host the podcast Thick as Thieves, which is a media company that they have, Thieves. So definitely go check them out. We love them. We'll tag them in all the video stuff that they did for us. But
I can't wait for you guys to see it.
I can't.
We are pre-recording
this. Yeah, this is 3 days before you guys get to see it. Yeah. So. But oh my God, y'all all loved our crossovers with Ladies and Tangents part one and part two.
We love them.
We are obsessed with them. And hi, if you're from Ladies and Tangents, welcome to the dark side.
And if you're from the Frogman drama, hello.
If you're from the Frogman drama,
welcome.
Hi. Welcome back. Yo, my God. Guys, that is so crazy what we're going through.
It was so much fun recording with them. And it was a good way to end our season.
It was perfect. Even with it being like as early as it was in it. Like it was perfect the way that it happened.
Yeah.
And I'm nervous as hell. I feel like I haven't been on camera on microphone
crazy
in
right
so
now.
Long.
I feel crazy.
Is our first time like really actually like full blown recording in the new
like
house,
my heart's
in the new studio.
Right now.
In
is
the
your
new
heart racing?
Yeah, dude.
Meanwhile, we have Nikki and McKenna here. Say hello.
Hey.
Like throw it back to season one whenever we would always have them in the background making comments.
How y'all doing?
So funny.
So we have a little live audience right now. They don't make me nervous. It's the room that makes me nervous.
Yeah, it's
right
the
now.
Room. It's the layout
the
of this room. And the three cameras all pointing at us. I can't. We also have a million ring lights.
Yeah, we do. That also is probably why the lighting's different.
The lighting is so different. And I just like haven't figured out how I want to sit in these new chairs just yet.
I'm liking how I am right now, but
my back's hurting me.
Well, I kind of like the
stretch.
Yeah, like
scratch. Hello.
I've had really, really bad back problems the last, what, 3-4 days
since moving all this stuff in the studio
and building and lifting. And I think I was just using muscles that I'm not used to because I don't fucking work out. Yeah. Sorry, hot works. But I don't. Guys, happy season 4.
Oh my God.
I can't even believe this, Taylor.
I feel like there's so many things that I wanted to talk about, but I just don't know what's going on.
I know. Like, I don't, I'm trying to, I don't want to spoil anything for them because we do have things kind of coming out the first 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's going to be, well, we don't, at this moment right now, is it?
It should, the second thing should be coming out, I guess, today or tomorrow, right? Our second merch launch.
Oh, the second merch launch. I think it comes out either today or next Tuesday at the latest.
Yeah.
So I would just stay on our Instagram because this is the one y'all been asking about.
Yeah, it is the one y'all bitches want.
This is the motherfucking one.
Y'all better eat that shit up,
y'all,
all right?
Y'all eating it up. Listen to me. Eat
blood,
it up.
Sweat, and tears went into that shit, all
a
right?
A lot of tears. Please. Please go eat that shit up.
Like, it's really cute. We're really excited for this launch. There's so a return excited. Of 2 big designs.
Yep.
So
some
that
those. Actually 3 big designs because.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Because the first one kept getting shredded with our old merch peeps, but not anymore.
The unshredded version.
Don't worry. We've gone into anti-shredding technology. We were like.
We mastered it. So.
We're going around talking to people.
But now that we say it. You know it's
going to
shred
just because we said it.
I know.
Let us know if it shreds.
Immediately
call us. Call my home line. Call my landline.
Call the home phone.
Call the home phone.
Is Taylor there?
Oh, guys, I guess we better get into it. We've got some good cases for you guys today. We haven't told each other what they are, but we're excited.
Yeah. We are so excited for season 4, but what we are even more excited about is the sponsor for today's episode, Factor.
Yes, you guys know we're obsessed with all of our Factor meals. They're ready to eat in 2 minutes. They're delish. We love their smoothies. So if you want some, you can head over to factormeals.com/creepsandcrimes50 and use our code creepsandcrimes50 to get 50% off.
That's code creepsandcrimes50 at factormeals.com/creepsandcrimes50 to get 50% off. Thanks, Factor. For the first time of season 4. If you're driving, throw that shit on cruise control.
If you got a glass, pour that shit up.
And let's get creepy!
All right, before we jump into this episode with these highly requested cases, we have got to tell you about our new favorite thing, and that's Honey Love.
We are obsessed.
We're obsessed. You guys know we love shapewear, but you know that I've had a really hard time becoming friends with bras.
It's a relationship that we're working on and that you have successfully accomplished with Honey Love.
If we would have never gotten sponsored by Honey Love, I don't think I would have ever found my bra of choice because for the last, 7 years, I've been going through different brands of bras, trying to figure out which one is best for me and the way that I like bras to feel. Because you know those, like, at the end of the day when you'd come home and take your bra off and you're in pain and you're dying?
Right.
Guess what? You don't have to do that anymore with Honey Love because they are amazing. You're going to never experience this again. Their bras are so comfortable. I forget that I'm wearing them.
Oh, really, though?
And Logan will be like, are you wearing a bra?
Right.
Why can't I see
shocked.
Your nipples?
Immediately
like,
shocked.
What's going on here?
Honey Love has revolutionize the bra game. So you can upgrade from traditional bras that are usually uncomfortable, underwire, and bulky fabrics that trap heat. Honey Love's bras feature supportive bonding that eliminates the need for underwire without sacrificing lift. Plus, they're made with that very soft fabric, and it feels like a second skin.
Plus, they have some mesh detailing that they add to their bras, and it gives them like this little touch of sexy. You just are never going to want to take it off. And you're never going to want to take it off. You might even sleep in it on accident because that's how amazingly comfortable it is. But guess what? Honey Love does not stop there. They have more than bras. I'm talking incredibly comfortable shapewear.
Period.
Which we know a lot about. We've been through a lot of shapewear. Morgan just whipped it out this weekend.
Go ahead and check the season 4 video because guess what we're wearing?
Honey Love, babes. They've got tanks. They've got leggings for everyday support.
So pair your V-bra with their breathable and versatile leggings or get the matching shapewear to your crossover bra. Honey Love has you covered for that everyday look, workouts, weddings, and more. Honeys, you need this in your life. You've earned it.
So treat yourself to the best shapewear on the market and save 20% off at honeylove.com/creepsandcrimes.
Use our exclusive link to get 20% off at honeylove.com/creepsandcrimes. Cinch, Snatched, and Lifted. It's hot girl season thanks to Honey Love.
Actually, it's hot ghoul season.
Hot ghoul season.
Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And here's your prescription.
I know just the pharmacy to get this filled.
Who are you?
A pharmacy benefit manager. A middleman your insurer uses to decide which medicines you can get, what you pay, and sometimes even which pharmacy you should go to.
Why can't I go to a pharmacy in my neighborhood?
Because I make more money when you go to a pharmacy I own.
No one should stand between you and your medicine. Visit phrma.org/middleman to learn more. Paid for by Pharma.
Okay, Morgan, what do you have for us today?
Hey, Taylor, the time has come.
I'm so excited.
I am covering your most requested case for me.
Tell me.
Jeff the Talking Mongoose.
I'm so fucking excited. I have never been so excited.
I know. Taylor has been asking me to cover this case since, oh God.
I mean,
season one.
It's season one because M did it on the podcast a long time ago, and I listened to it when I was going to my bachelorette.
Yeah, so we're here to give you the Walmart version of that.
Yeah, we're here to give you the great value version.
That's what it was.
Yeah, everyone just get on Shots Fired if you don't know what we're talking about.
Okay, so I'm just going to jump right into it. In the fall of 1931, the Irving family began to hear some strange noises around their home. Scratching, rustling, and even what they called, quote, vocal noises coming from the inside of their walls.
No.
Which is very similar to what happened to you, in the old house.
It is so similar.
Squirrels in the walls.
Did I have Jeff the Talking Mongoose?
I think you did. You might have had a little case of Jeff.
I think so.
This was an old farmhouse that was located at Dorlish Cashin near the village of Dalby on the Isle of Man between England and Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry if I mispronounce any of that. It was your stereotypical haunted house. But the Irving family had assumed that this entire case was just some rodents in the wall.
Yeah.
Just like how you assumed.
Definitely it was a raccoon or a squirrel.
Right. James and Margaret Irving had lived there for almost 15 years with no issues. So the paranormal wasn't on their mind at all.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret had given birth to their baby girl, Vori, and things were peaceful and silent around the house for 13 years. So when they heard this, assuming just pests or rodents, they just laid out some traps.
Yeah.
But as time went on, the sounds, specifically the vocal sounds, started to sound like baby gurgles.
Oh my God.
Immediately, no.
Immediately, I'm more terrified. Is there a baby on the wall?
It was like something that wanted to talk, but couldn't or didn't know how to.
Okay.
So those first year of baby talk.
Just goo goo gaga.
Goo goo gaga.
In your wall. Like, call the police. There's a child in my walls
and it's goo goo gaga.
And it's goo goo gaga-ing.
And the more that they did to prevent the sounds, the more it escalated. He continued to scratch and claw, and his noises became a bit more disturbing.
Oh.
He began making barking noises and sounded or escalated the baby gurgles to a baby crying.
Oh, God.
And then he started to mimic them.
That's where we draw the line.
But it was like a baby trying to mimic their parents. Say, okay. Daddy, da-da.
Da-da.
Goo-goo-ga-ga.
Goo-goo-ga-ga.
You know. And the more they interacted with him, the more he interacted back. Now, the story goes one of two ways here. Version one is that Vori, their 13-year-old daughter, was the one to discover Jeff. And she tells the family that they have a mongoose living in their walls and that he can talk. The family, of course, was skeptical, thinking it was just her imagination. But that was put to an end when this mongoose began having full-blown conversations with the entire family through the walls. The second version, which is the more popular version because of James Irving's diary that he wrote during this entire case, is that they heard noises from the attic and went to investigate. And this is when James uncovers this mongoose. From then on, he began to teach him how to talk, like kind of by parrot style. So he would say key words and then Jeff would repeat those words back.
Right.
James was just infatuated with this little weasel. And in return for teaching him, Jeff was very grateful and like respected James.
Right. You taught me how to talk. I'll be kind.
Right. Regardless of whether they taught him to talk or if he was found by their 13-year-old daughter talking, there was a fucking talking mongoose living in their house.
Yeah, let's just strip it down to the basics of what this like, actually
regardless
is.
Of what happened, there's a weasel there's talking.
A weasel literally talking.
Saying his name is Jeff. So before we begin, what the hell even is a mongoose? Think of a mix of a ferret, a weasel, a meerkat. That's a mongoose. They have really long faces and bodies. They have small ears, short legs, and long tails. And they sure as hell cannot speak English. They are native to Southern Europe, Africa, and Asia, which would track with Jeff's story. He begins to tell the family, through the walls, mind you, that his name was Jeff. And he was a, quote, extra clever mongoose. And a talking mongoose at that, who was born in New Delhi in 1852.
Oh.
And said, quote, to the family, and I shall haunt you with weird noises and clanking chains.
Jeff, please don't.
Jeff, what's up with the chains, brother?
I thought we were cool.
What are we? What
Where'd
are we,
you get the chains?
Let's chill.
Which Home Depot did you go to get that?
Let's relax a bit.
Yeah.
According to an interview in 1937 with James Irving, the Irving family went with us, and Jeff was notorious for playing pranks, but also would help around the house by chasing other wildlife away from the home.
Fair enough.
He was doing his chores.
He's a cat.
He was making his due, yeah. Paying his rent.
Yeah, he's Fair leaving enough. Gifts at the front door,
exactly.
Just like every good pet does.
Exactly. And as he got more comfortable with the family, Vori, the 13-year-old daughter, would sing nursery rhymes with Jeff, and he would sing them back or with her, and he would dance in return in the walls. He was dancing in the walls.
100%. That's so fantastic.
But he got a little too comfortable with the family and kind of had this mean streak going on, specifically with Margaret, the wife and the mom.
Why is he being mean to Margaret?
According to James, he would spy on her while she was disrobing before going to bed.
I'm sorry. And disrobing?
Yeah, you know, because she would wear a robe.
Yeah.
And he would call out the name of each item of clothing or underwear, underclothing, as she was removing them. So I'm not sure what this means, but if I was Margaret, this is what the situation would look like for me and a talking weasel in the damn wall. Triple XL Hanes t-shirt, socks that smell like roadkill, a thong that immediately needs to go in the hamper, sweats that have been on for 5 days. Like, is that what he's doing? Just narrating the situation?
Is he like...
Or is he like Victoria's Secret, extra sexy underwear?
Or is
like,
he...
Like, is he harassing her?
Like, first off, I'm gonna be like, Jeff, please stop announcing what I'm taking off my body, you fucking perv.
You literal perver?
You literal perv. Get out of here, you fucking pedo. Like,
well, what would your call outs be? What do you take off before
What are
bed?
You talking about? But before I get in the bed?
Yeah.
No, they're going to be like currently taking off
her heels that have been on since 9 a.m.
No. Because if I've been lounging around the house in my comfy clothes,
okay,
and maybe
yeah,
I'm
right.
Stripping down to the basics to get in the bed, so I'm not super sweaty. It's gonna be she's currently taking off her Adam Sandler sweatpants to have a hole right in the crotch. She's now adding on her XXXXL Adam Sandler
Triple
t-shirt
drip,
that has
Adam Sandler
every
shirt.
Bit. Of the fabric underneath the underarms ripped off.
To shred.
And she's adding on her Costco granny panties.
The guy knew those were
Yeah, coming they're going to be like, we're bringing the high-waisted XXL Costco granny
we
panties.
We have a serious problem with the same loungewear that we wear for weeks on
yeah.
to no end.
Yeah.
And I can picture your exact outfit that you're describing.
You literally know exactly what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And as he got even more comfortable with the family, he showed them that he was capable of not just speaking English, but also Russian, Manx, Hebrew, Welsh, Hindustani, Flemish, Italian, and Arabic.
Where the hell did he learn this? I thought we just were doing Goo Goo Gaga.
Yeah, well, first we were Goo Goo Gaga, and now all of a sudden you're, hola, ¿cómo te llamo?
Yeah.
Chill, Jeff.
Chill out, fucking Jeff.
So nobody had laid eyes on Jeff except for Vori, allegedly. Vori was the only one to have seen him, and she described him as being the size of a small rat with a large bushy tail and yellowish colored fur. And she even tried to photograph him, but Jeff was like super clever. Again, remember, he's the extra clever mongoose.
Yeah.
Self-centered motherfucker.
Yeah. He's really vain.
He wasn't falling for her game. He knew it was a trap, so he ditched the camera before Vori could get a picture.
Oh my God. Where are they? Wait, what year is this again? Digital cam later
on. Yeah, she just got a Canon.
You know, she's got to set that shit up, dude.
You know, the extra big flash. Yeah. She's got to step back out the room with like an X-ray.
Button it or it's going to explode in her face. Yeah.
Therefore, there isn't a picture of Jeff today. And then it gets a little crazy. Jeff was now an established member of the Irving family, meaning he began to explore the house more and even visit neighbors' homes with them and go on family walks with the Irvings. But how does this make any fucking sense? If Vori is the only one to have ever spot him and see him with her own eyes, how is Jeff out on family walks just hip-hopping around the town?
Right.
Well, obviously, he can change shapes and even go invisible.
Oh.
He's invisible.
He can go invisible. He's got the invisibility cloak.
He's now in Harry Potter.
It's literally right beside his chains in the wall.
Now we're in a Harry Potter movie. Yeah. Yeah, so the motherfucker was invisible. Like you said, again, he was an extra clever mongoose. He also would refer to himself as a spirit and a, quote, ghost in the form of a weasel.
Okay.
Regardless, the neighbors and the local townspeople were kind of like, what the fuck is going on with that family that walks down the road carrying conversation with no one?
With literally no one.
What's up with
thing?
The Irving family? Why are they walking down the road talking to an imaginary mongoose?
This weasel that they're claiming is in their walls with chains and an invisibility cloak. Like, he just sounds like they're crazy.
Exactly. And Jeff knew how the townspeople felt about him because he was a little bit of a gossip gatherer, meaning in his spare time, when he wasn't doing chores, wasn't calling out Margaret's clothes, wasn't playing with the chains on the wall, or singing nursery rhymes, he would go into the town or into other people's houses, listen to the piping hot town goss, and go and report back to the family.
Oh my God.
The shit starter.
He's honestly doing the Lord's work.
Now I want a talking mongoose.
Yeah, I want one too. He's like, I went over to your friend's house from school. She was talking shit about you.
Yeah, and that boy that you have a crush on, he likes your best friend.
And by the way, they said that you should never wear that corset to school again.
And Margaret, the townspeople are talking about your underclothing.
And Margaret, the townspeople are talking about your hair.
You should probably get some Victoria's Secret thongs.
Yeah, he's really tearing everybody's friendships apart.
Little fucking shit starter. Yeah, and I love that for him.
Me too. I wish I could have him.
Yeah. Jeff's story began to spread quickly and was the front page of almost every newspaper, resulting in a lot of journalists and paranormal investigators to pull up to the Irving house. But there was one person who got a special invitation to come check out Jeff by Mr. Irving himself. And that was the famous psychic investigator, Harry Price.
Harry Price.
Harry, alongside the editor of a BBC magazine called The Listener, his buddy's name was R.S. Lambert, but his nickname was Rex.
Mm-hmm.
Harry and Rex went to the Irving's house in 1935. And from this visit, the book called The Haunting of Cashin's Gap was made. Harry Price will be getting his own episode here in season 4.
Yeah.
Because that motherfucker is going to...
The
list goes on. But basically, he is a largely controversial British psychic researcher and author. He was known for his investigations into psychical phenomena and exposing fraud spiritualist mediums. But the one thing he loved the most was publicity.
Yeah.
Any exposure was good exposure for Harry Price. And legit, he probably dubbed that phrase. Like, that probably was made out of
him. I'm sure he was like,
Regardless, he was a believer in some supernatural elements, even though most of his evidence, whenever he would go out and do his research, most of that evidence had been proven to have been faked by Harry Price.
Mm-hmm.
So Harry Price goes out to investigate this talking mongoose in the walls of the Irving family household. But when they arrived, Jeff had mysteriously and conveniently disappeared and went invisible.
Oh, okay. Bye, Jeff.
And he remained invisible until they left. But this was because Jeff knew that Rex, the guy from the article that Harry Price brought with him, didn't believe in him.
Oh.
So why would Jeff even try to fuck around with a guy that shows so much disrespect to his name?
I mean, you know what, Jeff? And respect.
And Jeff probably knew that because he's eavesdropping in the hotel walls. Yeah, whoever they're saying.
Jeff was pulling up in your cart on the train.
He was listening to y'all talk about him.
Yeah, and you were sitting there just talking mad shit. So
he's like, fuck you guys, I'm not showing you my abilities.
Right, you don't get to write a tabloid article about this bitch.
Right. But prior to their invitation and their arrival, James had sent them a piece of Jeff's hair to be examined. Harry Price brought the hair with him and he compared it to that of the family's dog, and the dog's name was Mona. And Harry Price said that it was almost an exact match to Mona's hair.
Oh God.
Awkward.
Yeah, that's really awkward.
Regardless, it was sent to Julian Huxley, who was a biologist, and he sent it to a naturalist named F. Martin Duncan, who positively identified it as a dog hair. So it was not Jeff's hair.
Unless, well, that's embarrassing.
While at the house, Harry Price and Rex had captured some paw prints that were allegedly Jeff's by using like plasticine and like impression mix. And along with the paw prints, he gathered an impression of alleged tooth marks that were supposed to be Jeff's. The paw prints were weird, though, as the size of the front paws when compared to the back ones were significantly smaller.
Mm.
And according to Irving's, Jeff had human-like hands. So that was a little off.
Okay.
Harry Price asked Reginald Pocock, I believe, of the Natural History Museum to evaluate both the impressions of the paw prints and the tooth marks. And Reginald could not match it to any known animal. But he did suggest that the tooth marks were most likely that of a dog's. And he did confirm that none of the markings were made of the paw prints were made by a mongoose. So he did narrow that out. He's like, well, that's not a mongoose paw print. So Jeff's not a fucking talking mongoose. I don't know what he's fucking telling you.
Right. He's just a weasel.
He's just a typical ferret.
He's just a ferret.
While at the Irvings, he observed double walls of wooden paneling that covered all of the interior rooms of the farmhouse. And this had, inside these walls, there was a considerable amount of what they called interior airspace between the stone and the wood walls. And Harry Price said that that would make the whole house like one great giant speaking tube, kind of.
Okay.
With walls acting as the soundboards.
Okay.
So he suggested, because these panels had holes in them, that if you were to speak in one of the many holes in the panels, it could possibly turn into a voice in other parts of the house. So if you're sitting in the living room and you're talking into the wall, it could show up in the attic or in the bedroom upstairs as a voice coming
in through. Margaret's bathroom.
In Margaret's bathroom, triple XL drip. Yeah, t-shirt.
She's putting on her Adam Sandler fit right now.
Right, exactly. Ultimately, though, at the end of the trip, Harry Price had all the evidence to go public and state that Jeff probably was not real.
Ooh.
But if we know Harry Price, instead of doing that, he avoided saying that they believed the story and that they were just very careful on how they were going to report it.
Okay.
Nonetheless, they made a fucking book out of it. So.
Yeah, they were doing just fine.
They were fine. After all, he was just after the fame. According to Richard Wiseman, who is a professor at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK, this was a quote. Price and Lambert were less than enthusiastic about the case, concluding that the only most credulous of individuals would be impressed with the evidence of Jeff.
Credulous.
I don't even know what that means, credulous, but I think it would be like
the credulous of individuals.
Like, yeah, I don't fucking know.
Who knows?
Chill out, Richard Wiseman.
Yeah, what a big word. Jesus Christ.
We get your professor, but like just chill out. I mean,
your keyboard warrior ass, all right? Say that shit to my face.
And Harry Price wasn't the only known investigator to make their way out there to meet and hopefully talk to Jeff. Nandor Fodor, I know I'm butchering this. It's Nandor Fodor, F-O-D-O-R. Nandor Fodor, and I'm probably butchering that, who was a research officer for the International Institute for Psychical Research, actually stayed at the Irvings' house for an entire week to do an investigation on Jeff. Fodor repeatedly interviewed the Irvings, particularly James Irving, compiling a very thorough account of Jeff the Talking Mongoose, and this was then replicated in his 1951 book called Haunted People, Story of the Poltergeist Down the Centuries.
Oh.
So this bro's like, nah.
No.
This is a poltergeist.
It's a poltergeist.
Right. Fodor had an interesting take on poltergeist. He had completely ditched the theory that poltergeists were invisible spirits of the dead. And instead, he suggested that they were the psychic manifestations of a person's subconscious.
Oh.
Meaning that he believed that living people could conjure real hauntings with only their thoughts. And sometimes these hauntings were powerful enough to throw objects, levitate things, any typical poltergeist activity.
Right.
So basically, during these interviews, he focused his attention on the conscious mind of James Irving, which was the majority of his research. And at this time, his ways were heavily Sigmund Freud influenced, and it was very controversial. Some people even believe that because he was being so discredited at the time with his theory that he was trying to prove, he needed a new case to back up his theory. And this is kind of where Jeff comes in.
Got it. That makes sense.
Yeah. During his time, Fodor, what have I been saying?
I think we've been saying Fodor.
Fodor. During his time, Fodor investigated the scenes of Jeff's commonly placed antics. He interviewed witnesses and he tried his best to communicate with Jeff himself. But Jeff wasn't having it. So he never got to meet the talking mongoose, go fucking figure. In the end, he wrote the mongoose a goodbye letter because obviously Jeff could read too.
So you have got to write him a formal letter when you're leaving.
Yeah.
Or he's going to be pissed.
Didn't you know he knows how to read through the walls? He's got x-ray vision.
He's got x-ray
invisibility,
vision.
Invisibility, x-ray vision.
Do you think they dropped it in the wall?
Telecommunication. I don't know where they put it. That's a good question. And this is what it says. I am very disappointed you did not speak to me.
Oh.
Nonetheless, I believe you to be a very good and generous mongoose, and I brought you chocolate and biscuits.
Oh my God.
Okay, at least he's leaving parting gifts. That's kind of him.
I'll be there.
After a week there and reading through the document journals from James Irving, Fodor concluded a very complex theory to explain Jeff the talking mongoose. And this was that Jeff was a split-off part of James Irving's personality, and that James created him and projected him into the house because he was bored as fuck out in the middle of nowhere. Prior to moving to this house, so about 15 years before Jeff even got there, James Irving was living like this lavish life on the British mainland.
Uh-huh.
And he loved the city life. He loved the
motherfucking
towns,
city boy.
And he was a motherfucking city boy.
Yeah.
And now he's out in the boonies.
Yeah.
So
he's in the Isle of Man.
He was bored. And that would track to what Fodor is trying to explain here. The entire interaction between Nandor Fodor and Jeff was actually adapted into a movie that was like released like a year or two ago.
Oh,
and it's called Nandor Fodor and the Talking Mongoose.
Well,
I gotta
fair
watch
enough.
It.
Go
apparently,
find
it's
it.
A comedy. So,
oh, that'll
it's
be
a,
funny.
It's a British-made comedy. So, what is Jeff? Is he a hoax? A haunted weasel? Poltergeist? Split of James' mind? Like, what the hell is going
no,
on?
No, what is
here?
Going on?
Here are the facts. Jeff was never independently verified by anyone other than the family. Only Vori had seen him with her own eyes, and only the family had heard him talk, scratch, dance, and do the things that Jeff fucking did. When James Irving passed, so really did the story of Jeff. Mm. Jeff was never heard from again, nor has there been any other reports since James died. But here's a curveball. Vori had a hobby, a very special talent, and that was ventriloquism.
Oh, girl.
Vori was a known and effective ventriloquist.
Mm.
And people had caught her, people that came to the house to explore Jeff, had caught her making like really odd noises. And her dad would quickly like jump on it and explain like, oh, that's got to be coming from somewhere else. That's got to be Jeff. Like, there he is. Do you hear him? And Vori's over there like,
hey.
Gaga. And with the way the walls were double paneled, who is to say that it wasn't Vori all along? Or it was legit haunted animal that was powerful as fuck and made the family look crazy.
Yeah, it could be that.
Like, I don't know here. Chances are it was just a family thing, a joke or a hoax, or it was Vori and it had gone way too far.
Yeah.
But it was quite well known. And the story of Jeff the Talking Mongoose holds a very special place in the history of British folklore. And that is the story of Jeff the Talking Mongoose.
I'm obsessed with it.
Yeah, it's good.
Thank you so much, Morgan.
You're welcome.
I'm obsessed. I love Jeff the Talking Mongoose.
This is a good fucking
story. Hello, goose.
Little fucking.
It's so funny.
Fucking little tattletale rat is what he is.
Fucking little tattletale rat.
Wait, going around shit starting in the neighborhood.
What is like, why is it that this had like captured everyone so crazy?
I wonder if it was like one of the first like paranormal or like unexplained stories that hit the mass media then.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
In
the house, like, we'll post the pictures of the house on Instagram.
Yeah,
but it was like your typical, like, you're driving by, that house is haunted as fuck.
Yeah, you're like, okay,
you're like, now instead of saying that house is haunted as fuck, you're gonna be like, that house has a talking mongoose.
Yeah,
for sure.
That house has Jeff.
There's a Jeff.
Is it spelled like a regular Jeff?
It's G-E-F.
G-E-F.
It might be so, G-E-F-F. No, G-E-F.
Jeff. No.
But it's pronounced Jeff.
Jeff, yeah. Man, I loved it. Thank you so much. Yep.
Imagine all your audio entertainment available in just one place. That's what the Audible app is all about. With Audible, you can always find the best of what you love or discover something new. Audible has an incredible selection of mystery and thriller titles and originals, like Something Ain't Right by Roger Stringer and Zachary Stringer, The Space Within by Greg O'Connor and Josh Fagan, and the Audible original Moriarty. Membership includes access to Audible originals, podcasts, and tons of audiobooks that you can download or stream as much as you want. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title per month from an ever-growing catalog of titles to keep. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, doing chores, wherever your day takes you. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days.
You're welcome.
All right, my turn.
Okay.
All right, Taylor, what do you have for me today?
First, I had to go get a coffee because I'm going downhill real quick.
Oh,
I'm getting tired. We got it.
We just built these freaking chairs.
Literally, got delivered.
Anyone want the link, let us know.
Yeah, we'll send you the link. We're not gatekeeps, but I'm going to be covering a case that has been very highly requested.
I'm so excited.
For the longest, I am covering Black Dahlia.
Shut up.
Yeah, or Elizabeth.
You've been wanting.
Short. I've been wanting to do this. Let's just jump
Let's
into
it. Let's do it.
And I feel like most people know pretty much a lot of the warnings that come with this, but it's pretty graphic when describing the discovery.
Okay.
So at 10 a.m. on December 15th, 1974, Betty B. had to run to the store to get some shoes, and she had to run a couple of errands.
As
she should, queen. So she got herself and her three-year-old daughter, Anne, ready for the day before heading out. They were walking into town in the Lee Merritt, I'm not really sure, neighborhood in L.A. So we're in L.A.
Okay.
Strolling past this vacant lot on the west side of South Norton Avenue. As they're walking, Betty spots something out of the corner of her eye in this lot. She does a double take before she was able to compute what exactly it was that she was seeing. It was what looked to be at first a white store mannequin.
Oh no.
But upon her second glance, she realized that this was the dead body of a woman.
Was her daughter with her?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And her skin was so white that it looked like it was fake, and it was reflecting against the sun,
oh,
almost like
God.
A vampire would. Immediately,
the trauma.
Betty
dude.
Picks up her daughter and sprints to the closest home,
right,
and calls police. When investigators arrived at the scene, they were stunned. This woman looked like she was fake, lying nude, face up, hands above her head, elbows slightly bent, and her legs out straight and spread apart.
Oh, that sounds like a message to me.
As if she was meticulously posed that way. And her eyes were wide open.
Oh, that's fucked up.
The woman was not covered in blood or dirt or anything. She was perfectly cleaned. It made no sense because the scene was absolutely horrendous in terms of what everyone was seeing. This woman's body had been badly mutilated. There are really no words to describe how gory this discovery was, even without the blood and dirt and everything that you would expect at a crime scene, because this is a trigger warning. The woman was completely, perfectly severed in half at her waist.
Oh my God.
Her lower half was placed a foot away from her torso. It was clear that she had been hit over the head with some sort of a blunt object because the way that her head was bruised, but there were also pieces of flesh cut off of her body, cuts mainly Jesus. On her breast and thighs.
And there was no blood?
No blood. And the corners of her mouth had been slit open to her ears.
Oh my God. No, that is sadistic.
It's awful.
Can you imagine being the police
and having to walk up on this and there's no blood and what you're like
that's not
Betty having to be like, is this a mannequin or is this a person? Like, right. Imagine how close that she ended up getting. Because
like, that's like someone seriously sadistic. That's serial killer vibes.
Super
right there.
Fucked like, up. Yeah. This is not a first time kill.
Right.
Clearly.
Exactly.
You
oh
know?
My God.
Yet, no blood anywhere at the scene.
anywhere on this woman's body. After further examination, it was determined that the woman's body had likely been drained of all of its blood and other fluids.
What?
Then bathed.
Like embalmed.
Embalmed. Then bathed and scrubbed clean before being placed and posed in this vacant lot on Norton Avenue.
Oh my God.
As police worked the scene, blocking it off and searching for any other pieces of evidence, the crowd of passerbyers and reporters grew larger and larger and larger. Luckily, before all evidence was lost, investigators were able to locate a heel print on the ground near a tire track, as well as a cement sack that had watered down blood on it.
Near her?
Near her.
Okay.
But with all these people flooding the scene, investigators had to work really quickly at just like getting as much shit as they could and covering the body.
But also have some fucking respect. Back the fuck up.
Well, like this is a whole crime scene. This woman is completely exposed.
Specifically the reporters and the journalists.
Well, anyone that's coming to look at a crime scene. Like, first off, that's fucking weird.
Yeah.
Like there's a difference between being a looky-loo, like when you're driving.
When you're passing by, that's why I'm giving the public the benefit of the doubt right now, because you see a heavy, large police presence. But the journalists know why they're going there.
Yeah, they got the call. They got the call.
So back the fuck up.
Right. The first reporter on the scene was Aggie Underwood of the Los Angeles Herald Express. She and many others took photos of the woman's body and the crime scene, which is how and why we have so many real photos readily available on Google today and make it very easy to find. Like, you can just Google it. Police worked frantically to stop as many pictures as possible going around and like essentially standing in front of them so they couldn't get a picture, but it was making this crime scene even more frantic.
Right.
And they have no idea who this woman is. So if her body is posted in the newspaper,
her family could see
her that. Family could learn that way, and they need to go notify her family. But there just wasn't much that they could do. That she it was just happening so quickly, and so many more people were coming up. And so they're like having to decide between, should we honor this crime scene or cover it up and potentially fuck our evidence because we're trying to get everything out? Or do we just like cut our losses with the fact that someone's going to have some pictures?
Yeah.
Which is a really hard thing to determine.
For sure.
Because you want to be able to get that victim justice because you thoroughly check the crime scene.
Right. But if then you immediately start cleaning up and trying to, you're going to ruin your entire case that you have.
And then on the flip side, if you don't cover it up to maintain the crime scene's like viability in terms of what your evidence is, what type of evidence you're going to get, like you're going to end up having all these pictures around that you don't want out, which fucks you again, because it's like, if people can see what the crime scene looks like, there's nothing I can
hold. There should be a law that's like a 48-hour gag order on journalists and reporters.
Oh, dude.
That they are not allowed to expose current cases
if
they were at the scene for 48 hours or for 7
until police could like have enough time to be able to look and be like, we need this to stay in.
Yeah.
We need this to go out.
That should be a law.
I mean, really though, what there should be is like some sort of fucking wall that we could put up around a crime scene. That's like a makeshift goes up.
Like those fucking boxes outside the house.
Exactly. Exactly. Like we just need a gigantor like cheer mat that people can go and put up. It's super tall. And so that way.
Super quick.
Yeah. Really quick. Easy to do. Mm-hmm. So no one's like getting in and seeing shit that they shouldn't see. Okay. So an autopsy was performed on January 16th, 1947 by the LA County Coroner Frederick Newbar. According to Michael Newton's reportings in the Encyclopedia of Unsolved Crimes, the official autopsy report and death certificate stated that the woman was 5'5", 115 pounds at the time of her death. She had light blue eyes, brown hair, and badly decayed teeth. As for what the injuries told Newbar, the blunt force trauma to her head did not crack her skull, but it did bruise the front right side of her scalp. With only a small amount of bleeding, actual blood found on her body, it was coming from the inside of the front right side of her brain where that blow had hit her. But it wasn't like, it didn't crack her skull, so it was more of like a brain bleed.
Right.
And it was repetitive. Probably
put her unconscious.
Right. There was a, quote, gaping laceration that ran from the woman's belly button down to her pelvic region that was 110 millimeters long. The lacerations that ran from the corner of her lips to the sides of her face or ears were 3 inches long on the right side and 2.5 inches long on the left side. The woman's body had been cut in half using a 1930s technique called hemicorporectomy, meaning that her lower half had been removed by transecting between the second and third lumbar vertebra on her spine. I guess this is like a very different style than what was being used at the time. So this is a big deal. Neubauer also noted that there was very little bruising on the actual incision line, meaning that this was likely done post-mortem as if she was being embalmed. Trigger warning for SA and R. Lastly, her anal canal was dilated a pretty significant amount from what you would typically find, suggesting that she may have been raped or sodomized. However, there was no sperm found in her body, and it was determined that the woman's cause of death was hemorrhaging from the blows to her head and shock from the lacerations to her face. So the face lacerations happened prior to her death.
Jesus Christ.
And
that is a horrible, horrible scene, dude.
They cleaned her body with gasoline very carefully and methodically, like with a cotton swab. Like that's how.
Were there intentions to set it on fire or why gasoline?
They don't
think
they did gasoline. I don't think that they did the gasoline to burn the body.
Well, obviously,
they believe that
it
was to get rid of DNA. Which makes it, we've got this 1930s technique and we've got this very skilled person enough that they are thinking about
DNA, leaving
DNA in the
something.
40s.
Yeah.
So this has to be someone that has a medical background of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
With the help of the FBI, they were able to officially find the identity of the woman because of a 1943 arrest that she had and her fingerprints were in the system. Her name was Elizabeth Short. And she was 22 years old at the time of her death.
Damn.
After Elizabeth's name was released, reporters from the Los Angeles Examiner were able to track down her mother in Boston, Phoebe Short. But instead of telling Phoebe what had happened to her daughter, they told her that Elizabeth had won a beauty contest.
What? Yeah. Back me up.
So these reporters tracked down her mom, Phoebe Short, and they call her and are like, hey, we just want to give you a call because your daughter, Elizabeth, won a beauty contest.
What the fuck?
And what we're going to do is fly you out to LA to see her compete.
They need to go to jail.
So they offer for her to, they offer to fly her out to LA. They pay for her hotel and everything. And what they were doing was trying to get personal information about Elizabeth. So they didn't want to tell her the truth about her being murdered because they wanted more information. And they didn't tell her. They were like, we just need to know like her birthday, what she's been doing. We have to, you know, we're getting a write up about her since she won. Da, 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 da.
That is so demented. Twisted.
But you'd think like, okay, they're doing all this. They're flying her out to LA. They're paying for her hotel. Like they're going to hand her over to police, right?
Well,
to let
the
them
reporters
interview her.
Have a name and have found their mother. Why haven't the police contacted the mother?
That's what I'm getting at. Like, but they found her within the day. So they're working on the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
And they're over here being like, does anyone know who this girl is? What's her mom's name? Da, 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 da. So you'd think like, okay, like they're doing this fucked up shit. What are they going to do? Be like, once they get here, hand Phoebe, the mom, over to police and let her like get told this news and be at questioned and help in
their
investigation.
Don't they?
No, they were hiding Phoebe from the police. They did this because they wanted Elizabeth's personal information all to themselves so they could release it before the police told them they couldn't. And they were hiding Phoebe not only from other reporters, but also from police. And the media is, guys, this is just like the tip of the iceberg of what goes down in this case with the media. They were so fucking horrific and they continued to sensationalize this case as the Black Dahlia case, even though they knew Elizabeth's name.
Wow.
They described
her. So where does
her,
the name Black Dahlia come from?
we don't really know. Well,
the media.
I'll explain like what comes from this, but it did come from the media. So they were describing Elizabeth as an adventurous, prowling Hollywood Boulevard, and they gave her the name the Black Dahlia. And the day after Elizabeth's autopsy had began, so this is, it began on the 16th, it was the 17th that this happened, the LA Times published an article deeming her murder as a sex slaying.
Slaying.
Yeah. Like, not like slaying, but like slaying.
Right.
Yeah, not good.
And what right did they have to even conclude that?
It was fucking disgusting. They had no basis for it. They did not care about Elizabeth or her story. They just cared about their story and how they could get so the public Harry to buy Price into Jr. it.
Okay.
Exactly. So because they didn't do it, I will tell you who Elizabeth Short is and her life story. So Elizabeth was born on July 29th, 1924 in Hyde Park, Boston, Massachusetts, as the third of five daughters belonging to Cleo Alvin Short Jr. and Phoebe Mae Sawyer. Cleo was a U.S. Navy sailor before he began building mini courses, like golf mini courses for his like living.
Like putt-putts?
Yeah, like putt-putts. Like that's what he did. Okay,
I love that.
Really fun. And Phoebe was a stay-at-home mother. 5 years after Elizabeth's birth in 1929, just after the birth of her youngest sister, Cleo lost almost all of his savings in the stock market crash and was really struggling to provide for his family. In 1930, after not returning home one day, his car was found abandoned on the Charlestown Bridge with no sign of him. It was assumed that he had jumped into the river, taking his own life. Therefore, Phoebe was forced to take over for providing for herself and their five daughters while grieving her husband all alone.
Oh, damn.
She began working as a bookkeeper to be able to do this. But when Elizabeth was 15 in 1939, after many years of having severe asthma attacks and just like constant bronchitis, she needed emergency lung surgery. And to help herself heal and not have this reoccurring issue every single month, her doctors told her that she needs to go move somewhere that's warmer. And she couldn't live in Boston during the winters. It was just too harsh on her lungs. So Phoebe sends Elizabeth to spend all of the winters with her family friends in Miami for 3 years in a row. And this causes a lot of stress when it comes to school. You know, like she's still in high school. She's trying to get through and having to go back every time it's fucking cold in Boston.
Yeah.
So most of the time down to Miami so her lungs can like actually function right and heal. By her like sophomore year of high school, she ends up dropping out because all of the back and forth was just too much. Well, towards the end of 1942, Phoebe Short, Elizabeth's mom, receives this letter in the mail. And it was an apology written to her from Cleo, her husband, that had died.
What?
Yeah. He's like, hey, I'm alive. I didn't commit suicide. Sir? I staged my death.
Sir, I abandoned my five daughters.
And I moved to California. And I started up a new life. I have money now. I want to get a relationship with you, but I want to stay in California. I don't want to go back to Boston.
Excuse me?
Excuse the fuck out of me.
I would have been like, you immediately send me child support for the last however many.
5 years. 5 years that we've been gone or whatever it is. Are you kidding me?
Oh, what a fucker.
But you know what? Then I'm like, on the flip side, I'm like, thank God he didn't family annihilate. Like he just dipped out.
Yeah.
I'd much rather you do that than...
Right. I'm with you.
So, and you know, men back in this time, they would just annihilate people. So he's like, hey, I want to have a relationship with you and my daughters again. And she's like, you can go fuck yourself.
But you can send me the money.
I'll give them the option, you know? And specifically, she's thinking about Elizabeth. Like, this way she doesn't have to go in Miami. She can live with her dad and finish school out in California. And that's exactly what happens. Elizabeth moves out.
With her ghost daddy.
With her ghost daddy in December. So just a month later or so. And she's 18 years old at the time in Vallejo, California to live with her father instead of going back and forth between Boston and Miami. So at the time, Cleo was working at Mare Island Naval Shipyard when his daughter, who he had not seen since she was 6 years old. So it's not been 5 years. He left when she was six.
Whoa. 12 years.
Now, unfortunately, they were just not in a place to heal their relationship yet. So it got
pretty bad pretty quickly. And they were just constantly arguing and fighting with each other. And this leads to Elizabeth moving out of her dad's house. So Elizabeth moves out of her father's house and she gets a job at the base exchange for Camp Cook, which is where she met a U.S. Army Air Force sergeant. Man. And these two, they went from seeing each other to being with each other real quick.
All right. They got it on.
They got it on. But she moves in with him. Everything's fine and dandy, honeymoon phase. But after a few months, it gets really negative and he starts abusing Elizabeth. So finally, in the summer of 1943, Elizabeth has the opportunity that she can leave him. Mm-hmm. And she moves to Santa Barbara, where she later gets arrested for underage drinking at a bar on September 23rd, 1943, which is where those fingerprints came from.
All right, well, girl went through it, so if she wants to go get a drink, she can go get a fucking drink.
Right, exactly. So authorities, when she gets arrested in this arrest in Santa Barbara, send her back to live with her mother because they're like, you're underage, you need to go back. I'm like, she's 18.
Yeah. This wasn't the legal drink. Wasn't are 18
you, I thought then? So, right? In the 40s? So they're like, okay, you're in trouble, but you don't have to go to prison. We're just going to send you back to live with your mom in Boston. But Elizabeth, like, they like put her on a train or whatever to get back over there. And she doesn't go back to Boston.
Right. She's like, I mean, are you going to drive me there?
Well, she's like, first off, it's cold. It's September. So I'll die. And so instead, she just goes back to Miami. So she goes back to Miami instead of going to Boston, hangs out with those family friends again. But she's like making friends as she's there. And this is where she meets Major Matthew Michael Gordon Jr.
Okay.
Major Matthew Michael Gordon Jr.
Say that five times fast.
Let's see. Hear
Major
it.
Michael Matthew Jordan Jr. Major Matthew,
Gooner.
Major Matthew Michael Jordan Gooner. Major Matthew Michael Jordan Gooner.
No, no.
Gordon.
Okay, anyways. So he was training for deployment into the Southeast Asian theater of World War II. He was this like very well-known, decorated Army Air Force officer of the 2nd Air Commando Group.
Good for him.
Good for him. And the two were madly in love. He was so good to her. And he promised, like, they together promised themselves, like, for each other because he was getting sent off to war. He's being deployed. So he gets sent off. And after being there for a little while, Gordon writes a proposal letter for Elizabeth's hand in marriage while recovering from a plane crash that he suffered from in India. So he's writing her.
And he, two things.
He's like, I've realized that you're the love of my life and I don't want to lose you. Like, imagine getting a letter like that.
I was in a plane crash, marry me.
Yeah, like, oh my God, okay, I'm on my way. I'll be here in a minute.
I'm coming,
babe. Yes. She writes back and she accepts his offer to have her hand in marriage. But he never received the letter because he was in a second plane crash and died on August 10th, 1945.
Oh my God.
Isn't that so sad?
That is heartbreaking.
So after grieving the loss of Gordon, Elizabeth moves to L.A. And there she met up with one of their friends, like their mutual friends from Florida. And he was Army Air Force Lieutenant Joseph Gordon Fickley.
These names.
You thumbs up Mila.
No, I thumbs up Mila. Good girl.
She's like, can I come sit in your lap then?
No one will let me on their fucking lap.
Okay, here we go. There she meets up with their mutual friend from Florida, Army Air Force Lieutenant Joseph Gordon Fickling.
What's up with the tongue twister name?
And why are they everyone's names Gordon in this? Yeah, like, it must have been a poppin' name, Gordons. Right? So anyways, they knew each other from Florida. And he's like stationed at this Naval Reserve Air Base in Long Beach. And he's like, look, stay with me until you get settled. Then we can get you an apartment. We'll find you a job. Like, you need to start over. Elizabeth gets a job working as a waitress. And she saves up a lot of money to be able to rent this room behind the Florentine Gardens nightclub on Hollywood Boulevard.
Oh, slay.
Okay, Elizabeth. And according to some sources, she really began focusing on herself during this move and her goals and working on her skills because she wanted to become an actress and make connections.
Ooh.
That was like her dream, according to some sources. Some say that that's not true, that it was made up by the media, which at this point,
who knows? Yeah.
Who fucking knows? Sad. On January 9th, 1947, just days before her death, Elizabeth had just gotten back to LA after this quick little trip that she took with her boyfriend, 25-year-old Robert Red Mainline, to San Diego. And we find out later that he's a cheating married man. But let me get this right. He's a salesman.
Okay.
Ladies. Sorry. It's something about these fucking salesmen. I feel like anything I'm like telling a case, I'm like, yeah. And his mistress, by the way,
yeah,
he was a salesman.
He probably worked for the American company of water.
What was it?
Or Amway or Amtrak or whatever it was.
Amtrak. Whatever. I think that's the food in the stadium.
Oh, Amtrak. No, that's the like subway. It's a train. It's like an air train. That was a train.
Just remember, you know, like buying something in the stadium, it would come up with a crazy name.
It's like a mark or something.
Amark.
Amark. That, oh, I bet it's a market.
A mark.
And it's like the short version. Like,
yeah.
Market.
Because I remember I would have always been the negative. I'm like, I don't know what the fuck this $15 Amark times 40 is, Mom. I was just buying Petros.
Yeah, I was just eating. That's it. Good God. Okay. So he's this married motherfucker. We don't know if she knew. Some sources say that she knew. Some say that she didn't. Either way. So mainly stated that he dropped Elizabeth off in downtown LA at the Biltmore Hotel because this is where she was planning to meet her sister that afternoon that was coming in to visit from Boston. Now, witnesses at the hotel did recall seeing Short talking on the phone in the lobby before going to the Crown Grill Cocktail Lounge, which is like just a few doors down. And that was the last time that she was ever seen before she was found dead on January 15th. Elizabeth's case was all over the media.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that everybody was talking about, which made it hard for police to sift through everything that was coming in, because obviously, like, when everyone's talking about this, like, people are going to end up, it's a double-edged sword. You're gonna probably get a lot more information that's viable, but more so fake shit.
Right.
Because people are weird.
People just want clout.
They just want clout, like Frogman.
Yeah.
Frogman. So they're sifting through all of these leads and these tips that are pouring in, and they're trying their best to single out as many as possible and verify them before moving forward so that way they're not wasting time on false leads. On January 21st, a phone call comes in to the editor's office of the Examiner. This editor was named James Richardson. And this caller is like, hey, I just want to congratulate you on your paper's coverage of the Black Dahlia case, but I am Elizabeth Short's killer, so...
What?
Yeah, that's exactly how the entire conversation went. It was like, hey, you're doing such a good job covering this, but I know more than you because I killed her.
Fucking sadistic,
so
bro.
This dude, the editor, Richardson, he's like, what the fuck? Like, he could barely get any information out. And he's like, well, who are you? And the killer on the other end, this so-called killer, is like, look, I'm going to turn myself in. Don't worry too hard about the details. But I just want to give police some time at first. So let's see if they can actually get me. Like, I'm going to basically being like, I want to see just how close police can get.
Yeah.
And then I'll turn myself in when they get a little too close.
Whoa.
So finally, before hanging up, this man on the other end of the phone tells Richardson to, quote, expect some souvenirs of Beth Short's in the mail. Beth? You know her well enough to call her Beth?
Yeah, for a second I was like, who's Beth? But Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, right. Now, thinking this is yet another prank call or just some weirdo just like calling in to like get himself involved in the case, the editor Richardson, he doesn't think much about this. But then on January 24th, a suspicious manila envelope addressed to the, quote, Los Angeles Examiner and other LA papers, end quote, arrives at the newspaper's office. It was not like handwritten. The individual words had been cut out and glued onto the envelope.
Like a scrapbook?
From newspapers. Yeah.
What the fuck?
Now, on the face of the envelope, there was also another message written out the same way that said, here is Dahlia's belongings, letter to follow. Inside of this packet, there were countless documents, such as Elizabeth Short's birth certificate, names written on a piece of paper, an address book that belonged to a man named Mark Hansen, tons of photos, and business cards.
Whose business cards? We don't know.
They haven't announced it. And if they have, I was not able to find the specifics of that.
I mean, that is just so twisted. That's somebody that is the Zodiac.
Yeah. Like, this is someone who's playing a really big media game.
Right.
This is...
And that's all they want.
Goes along with the MO of the way that she was discovered. Presented, and posed, yeah. And cleaned. Like, very much like an art gallery.
Mm-hmm. Look at me.
Exactly. Yeah. Police examined that package to find that it had been carefully cleaned with gas, just like Elizabeth's body, which pretty much confirmed that this was the real
thing. But that exact same day, a report came in to the police about a suspicious purse and black suede shoe that were allegedly spotted on top of a garbage can in an alley just 2 miles away from the crime scene. So police go to this location and they recover the items. But just like the packet and Elizabeth, they had been cleaned with gasoline. They were not hopeful in finding any sort of physical evidence on any of these items due to the gasoline, which is why they couldn't get anything from Elizabeth's body. However, they were able to lift several partial fingerprints off of that envelope package, and they sent this over to the FBI for comparison and testing.
Good shit.
2 days later, on January 26th, the examiner received yet another letter. And this time, the letter was handwritten, and it read, quote, here it is. Turning in Wednesday, December 29th, 10 a.m. Had my fun at police. Signed, the Black Dahlia Avenger.
Avenger?
Avenger. Sir?
Okay, Captain America.
That's not what the Avengers do.
Get a fucking reality check.
You need to get a grip, bitch.
For real.
What, like, how dare you? So on December 29th, police go to this location that was specified in the letter, and they waited and they watched, yet no one ever came. Finally, at 1 p.m., another letter arrived at the examiner's office. This one, once again, was not handwritten, but instead cut and pasted newspaper words. And it read, have changed my mind. You would not give me a square deal. Dahlia's killing was justified.
What?
Now, what's really weird about this, if that's not weird enough, is somehow, some way, those prints from the packet were, quote, compromised during their delivery to the FBI, making it to where they could not be tested or analyzed.
Be for real.
Who did that? So is this a postal worker? Is this someone within the law enforcement realm?
Right. That's what I'm starting to think. Who would tamper with it?
Who
like
would
that?
Be able to intersect that and know where it was going?
Right.
And who had it? So.
Damn.
It felt like one roadblock after another for investigators. They were really only left with bits and pieces that they had, and it forced them to look at all of these pieces from every single possible angle to determine what leads could be gathered or created from the evidence that they still had. Now, one really interesting thing that stood out to investigators was that address book with the name Mark Hansen on it. Because police knew Hansen. He was a very, very, very wealthy local theater and nightclub owner. But what was even more interesting to police was the fact that Elizabeth Short knew Mark Hansen. In fact, they knew each other so well that recently, within months before her death or weeks even, according to some reports, he had allowed Elizabeth and a friend to stay with him at his home.
But why would he just throw his name out there like that?
Right. Why would his name be wrapped up in it unless
he
being
framed? To me, immediately
framed?
As an investigator, I would be like, well, he's just framed.
This is a red herring at that point. So, but they have to do their due diligence. Right. And so they go and they question
maybe
Hansen.
Maybe he is sadistic enough to put his own
exactly. Down. And they showed him every single thing that they had found. And they asked for further details about his and Elizabeth's relationship. And over the course of being shown the photos of evidence, Hansen actually confirmed that the purse and the shoe that they found in that alley did in fact belong to Elizabeth. He was like, yeah, those are 100% hers. Like, that's how close they were. That's how well they knew each other, that he like knew her accessories.
Mm-hmm.
So,
damn.
Red flag, but also like at the same time, if you got called in or if Aaron got called in and maybe there, I don't know, a pair of tennis shoes that I wear all the time, like my white ones or my Steve Madden ones, like he could probably be like, yeah, you know what? Those are Taylor's
shoes.
Sure. She wears them all the time.
Right. And that's her Adam Sandler t-shirt.
That's her Adam Sandler t-shirt. We all know that one. Yeah. You know? Or maybe my purse, like my three main purses. If Aaron or Logan saw ours, like they would be able to identify them just as like a man that's semi-close to us in our lives without mm-hmm. being like that close. So I don't want to say that that's weird, but
yeah,
it could be something. You. But what Hansen, okay, that's how close that they were. He knew her accessories. So could be a red flag, could be a green flag. But either way, what Hansen didn't know as he's being questioned was that police were not interviewing him because of his address book being found. They were instead looking at him as a suspect, like a primary suspect. And they knew that he did have some motive for wanting Elizabeth dead. Investigators had just interviewed Elizabeth's best friend and roommate, Anne,
about any potential connections that Hansen had with Elizabeth outside of, you know, hanging out for a bit. To which Anne informed them that Elizabeth had a really unsettling encounter with Hansen just weeks before her death, in which she rejected Hansen's, quote, sexual advancements.
And a rejected man.
And he was not happy about it.
Cray.
After intense interrogations and failing to find anything more that could connect Hansen to Elizabeth's death, investigators cleared him. Meanwhile, they were also interviewing 150 other men that they believed could be potential suspects, including Red Mainley, the man that had dropped her off and was her boyfriend, the married salesman. He was quickly cleared after passing a number of polygraphs and having his alibi confirmed of not being there anymore. By February 1st, investigators told the press that the case had, quote, run into a stone wall with no new leads to pursue and no new pieces of evidence. And because there were no new finds, this left the media almost clamoring to keep this headline going. So what did they do? What all nasty ass unethical journalists do. They stopped fact checking and running every single fucking story that they could get their hands on, whether it was true or not.
Wow.
And releasing crucial information about the investigation that police did not give them. And did not want out.
Dirty fucking dogs. Anything for publicity.
Exactly. They made up details about the crime scene, saying that police believed that Elizabeth had been brutally tortured for hours and hours prior to her death, which was not true, or at least not confirmed at that point in time. They dug incredibly deep into Elizabeth's personal life and published every single thing that they found, claiming that she was a lesbian / sex worker.
Jesus.
And people are like, okay, it could be she could have been a sex worker, like an escort, to try and get herself money and get her into the space of all the other wealthy
right,
men.
Right, but let's
as an
not,
actress. But like, why is that a negative
sure,
thing?
Exactly.
Right. And if she's a lesbian, who gives a fuck?
Right.
And why does that need to be on the front page? And then what does
and
that justify
of,
her
think
death?
Think of the time, though. Think of the 40s. Like, being a lesbian and a sex worker was a huge deal. So they're sitting there fucking defaming the victim.
Exactly. They're trying to make it seem like she's not anyone that you would need to care about, yeah. Which would then in turn hurt them.
Right.
Because if no one cared about her death,
right,
then you don't have a story to sell. So I don't get what their fucking motive with that was, but whatever. They even announced that she had declined the sexual advancements from Hansen, and that a friend of hers once said, quote, she liked to get guys worked up over her, but she'd leave them hanging dry. Eventually, this bullshit kind of slows down. But it was only because there were actual developments in the case that kind of took that spotlight away from these fake fucking stories that they were running. So in mid-February, the LAPD serves a warrant to the University of Southern California Medical School requesting complete records from every single program students. Why? The university sat just 2 or so miles away from the location that Elizabeth was found, and we're looking for someone who has a medical background.
Right.
Background checks were ran on every single student and faculty member. However, nothing came of this, really. On March 14th, a pile of men's clothes were found at the foot of Breeze Avenue in Venice by the ocean's edge, and it was found by a beach caretaker. Now, this caretaker immediately runs to the lifeguard, and the lifeguard was Captain John Dillon, and he notified West LA Police Captain Ellie Christensen. So while investigating, detectives found tucked inside of one of the shoes, like wrapped up in this pile of clothes, there was an apparent suicide note that read, quote, to whom it may concern, I have waited for the police to capture me for the Black Dahlia killing, but have not. I am too much of a coward to turn myself in, so this is the best way out for me. I couldn't help myself for that or this. Sorry, Mary.
Mary?
End quote. Who's Mary?
Who is Mary?
We don't know. We do not know. Nothing about this letter or the clothing found was able, like, suggested who the owner of it would be. Like, there was no, like, initials. There was no, it was just Mary. Sorry, Mary. Written at the bottom. So they did not know who these belonged to, and they were trying to get someone to come forward. They were looking for cars that had been abandoned, people that had been dropped off there, if there were any witnesses. they could not really get anything. So by the end of the spring of 1947, within months of her murder, Elizabeth's case went cold. Even with the 750 LAPD investigators and various other agencies working on this case alongside 400 sheriff's deputies and 250 California State Patrol officers, along with the incredible amounts of searches done in storm drains, abandoned buildings, I mean, the banks of the LA River, anywhere that they could search, they were doing these intense searches just trying to find something. And they even offered a $10,000 reward for any information. And again, this is in the 40s.
Yeah, that's due diligence.
That's a lot of money too, right? Yeah. A lot of manpower. Yet there was nothing. Police worked with many different agencies to try and come up with at least something that would help them understand what happened and why it happened. Lead investigator Captain Jack Donahue theorized that Elizabeth's murder had to have taken place in a remote building or shed on the outskirts of LA before being transported and posed in the location that she was discovered, with the number one thing standing out to them being the surgical precision of Elizabeth's injuries. Mm-hmm. This took skill, practice, and knowledge. In fact, Detective Harry Hansen said that in his opinion, quote, the killer was a top medical professional and a fine surgeon.
And it took probably medical devices.
100%. Yeah. Which is why investigators got that warrant for the medical school. And also, FBI profiler John E. Douglas.
Ooh.
I get like chills when I talk about him. This is so iconic. This is what he had to say, quote, about the killer. He was desensitized to blood, was comfortable with a knife, and although he had a medical degree, he did work with his hands rather than his brains. He also had a strong but troubled link to the immediate vicinity of the crime scene, end quote. But to be completely honest, which the lead detectives have even said themselves, is that they had been doomed from the very beginning. For one reason only, the media. It
Absolutely.
Was a circus, and it completely blew all validity out of the water because of how much this case was sensationalized. No matter what police did to try and correct this, keeping the details on the case within a small group of trusted high-up investigators, gag orders, giving more info to try and correct the misinformation, on and on and on, nothing was working. And the false confessions and leads just continued to pile up and throw them off course even more with every single one that came in. In fact, by 1949, there were over 60 people that had confessed to murdering Elizabeth Short, and even more people that offered up their own relatives as the murderer to try and get that 10 grand. And since then, over 500 people have falsely confessed to murdering Elizabeth Short.
For what? For why?
Including individuals that were not even born at the time.
Wow.
Over the years, investigators and professionals have narrowed the suspect pool down to 24 people. So obviously, that's a huge pool of suspects, and many make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them make sense and have opportunity and motive and everything. So I can't go through the whole list, but I'm going to go through
some
the
notorious people that we know
ones. Right. But it's going to take me so long that I'm going to have to do it next week.
Because dun, dun, dun.
I got another 20 pages that we could go through. So
Sorry for the two-parter,
but babies.
But it do be like that sometimes.
It's like that sometimes.
On those cases you request.
Yeah. Like the Black Dahlia, you want me to take that easy?
Yeah.
You want me to take it
easy?
You know
that can't happen.
I'm not going to do that. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for listening to the first episode of season 4.
I can't even believe it.
I'm like
sick. Look
at me.
I'm so chilled, laid back in this chair. Like, I'm loving.
No, my legs are asleep, but I don't even care because I'm so comfy.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's amazing.
I'm really enjoying myself.
Happy season 4.
Happy season
Let's
4.
Let's freaking rock this
Let's
year.
Let's freaking lose it.
Let's freaking lose it.
Boom.
Get out of your mind. Let's rock this bitch.
All right, guys, we're going to let you go. Thanks so much for listening to the first episode of season 4, episode 158. We'll see you guys next week.
We'll see you next week. Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye. Mwah.
Please note that this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services. Individuals on the show may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to in this episode.